to make Mike and Jessica happy at the same time. I could see Jessica glowering at us now. The numbers worked out in my favor, though. Lee brought two extra people, and suddenly every seat was necessary. I managed to wedge Jess in between Mike and me in the front seat of the Suburban. Mike could have been more graceful about it, but at least Jess seemed appeased. It was only 15 miles to La Push from Forks, with gorgeous, dense green forests edging the road most of the way, and the wide Quilla Ute River snaking beneath it twice. I was glad I had the window seat. We'd rolled the windows down. The Suburban was a bit claustrophobic with 9 people in it, and I tried to absorb as much sunlight as possible. I'd been to the beaches around La Push many times during my Forks summers with Charlie, so the mile-long crescent of First Beach was familiar to me. It was still breathtaking. The water was dark gray, even in the sunlight, white-capped and heaving to the gray, rocky shore. Islands rose out of the steel harbor waters, with sheer cliff sides, reaching to uneven summits, and crowned with austere, soaring firs. The beach had only a thin border of actual sand at the water's edge, after which it grew into millions of large, smooth stones that looked uniformly gray from a distance, but close up were every shade a stone could be: terracotta, sea green, lavender, blue-gray, dull gold. The tide line was strewn with huge driftwood trees, bleached bone white in the salt waves, some piled together against the edge of the forest fringe, some lying solitary, just out of reach of the waves. There was a brisk wind coming off the waves, cool and briny. Pelicans floated on the swells while seagulls and a lone eagle wheeled above them. The clouds still circled the sky, threatening to invade at any moment, but for now the sun shone bravely in its halo of blue sky. We picked our way down to the beach, Mike leading the way to a ring of driftwood logs that had obviously been used for parties like ours before. There was a fire circle already in place, filled with black ashes. Eric and the boy I thought was named Ben gathered broken branches of driftwood from the dryer piles against the forest edge, and soon had a teepee-shaped construction built atop the old cinders. "Have you ever seen a driftwood fire?" Mike asked me. I was sitting on one of the bone-colored benches, the other girls clustered, gossiping excitedly on either side of me. Mike kneeled by the fire, lighting one of the smaller sticks with a cigarette lighter. "No," I said as he placed the blazing twig carefully against the teepee. "You'll like this, then. Watch the colors." He lit another small branch and laid it alongside the first. The flame started to lick quickly up the dry wood. "It's blue," I said in surprise. "The salt does it. Pretty, isn't it?" He lit one more piece, placed it where the fire hadn't yet caught, and then came to sit by me. Thankfully, Jess was on his other side. She turned to him and claimed his attention. I watched the strange blue and green flames crackle toward the sky. After a half hour of chatter, some of the boys wanted to hike to the nearby tidal pools. It was a dilemma. On the one hand, I loved the tide pools. They had fascinated me since I was a child. They were one of the only things I ever looked forward to when I had come to Forks. On the other hand, I'd also fallen into them a lot. Not a big deal when you're 7 and with your dad. It reminded me of Edward's request that I not fall into the ocean. Lauren was the one who made my decision for me. She didn't want to hike, and she was definitely wearing the wrong shoes for it. Most of the other girls besides Angela and Jessica decided to stay on the beach as well. I waited until Tyler and Eric had committed to remaining with them before I got up quietly to join the pro-hiking group. Mike gave me a huge smile when he saw that I was coming. The hike wasn't too long, though I hated to lose the sky and the woods. The green light of the forest was strangely at odds with the adolescent laughter. Too murky and ominous to be in harmony with the light banter around me. I had to watch each step I took very carefully, avoiding roots below and branches above, and I soon fell behind. Eventually, I broke through the emerald confines of the forest and found the rocky shore again. It was low tide, and a tidal river flowed past us on its way to the sea. Along its pebbled banks, shallowed pools that never completely drained were teeming with life. I was very cautious not to lean too far over the little ocean ponds. The others were fearless, leaping over the rocks, perching precariously on the edges. I found a very stable-looking rock on the fringe of one of the largest pools and sat there cautiously, spellbound by the natural aquarium below me. The bouquets of brilliant anemones undulated ceaselessly in the invisible current. Twisted shells scurried about the edges, obscuring the crabs within them. Starfish stuck motionless to the rocks and each other, while one small black eel with white racing stripes wove through the bright green weeds, waiting for the sea to return. I was completely absorbed, except for one small part of my mind that wondered what Edward was doing now. I tried to imagine what he would be saying if he was here with me. Finally, the boys were hungry, and I got up stiffly to follow them back. I tried to keep up better this time through the woods, so naturally I fell a few times. I got some shallow scrapes on my palms, and the knees of my jeans were stained green, but it could have been worse. When we got back to First Beach, the group we'd left behind had multiplied. As we got closer, we could see the shining, straight black hair and copper skin of the newcomers, teenagers from the reservation come to socialize. The food was already being passed around, and the boys hurried to claim a share while Eric introduced us as we each entered the driftwood circle. Angela and I were the last to arrive, and as Eric said our names, I noticed a younger boy sitting on the stones near the fire glance up at me in interest. I sat down next to Angela, and Mike brought us sandwiches and an array of sodas to choose from, while a boy who looked to be the oldest of the visitors rattled off the names of the seven others with him. All I caught was that one of the girls was also named Jessica, and the boy who noticed me was named Jacob. It was relaxing to sit with Angela. She was a restful kind of person to be around. She didn't feel the need to fill every silence with chatter. She left me free to think undisturbed while we ate. And I was thinking about how disjointedly time seemed to flow in Forks, passing in a blur at times, with single images standing out more clearly than others. And then at other times, every second was significant, etched in my mind. I knew exactly what caused the difference, and it disturbed me. During lunch, the clouds started to advance, slinking across the blue sky, darting in front of the sun momentarily, casting long shadows across the beach and blackening the waves. As they finished eating, people started to drift away in twos and threes. Some walked down to the edge of the waves, trying to skip rocks across the choppy surface. Others were gathering a second expedition to the tide pools. Mike, with Jessica shadowing him, headed up to the one shop in the village. Some of the local kids went with them, others went along on the hike. By the time they had all scattered, I was sitting alone on my driftwood log, with Lauren and Tyler occupying themselves by the CD player someone had thought to bring, and three teenagers from the reservation perched around the circle, including the boy named Jacob and the oldest boy who had acted as spokesperson. A few minutes after Angela left with the hikers, Jacob sauntered over to take her place by my side. He looked 14, maybe 15, and had long, glossy black hair, pulled back with a rubber band at the nape of his neck. His skin was beautiful, silky and russet-colored. His eyes were dark, set deep above the high planes of his cheekbones. He still had just a hint of childish roundness left around his chin, altogether a very pretty face. However, my positive opinion of his looks was damaged by the first words out of his mouth. "You're Isabella Swan, aren't you?" It was like the first day of school all over again. "Bella," I sighed. "I'm Jacob Black." He held his hand out in a friendly gesture. "You bought my dad's truck." "Oh," I said, relieved, shaking his sleek hand. "You're Billy's son. I probably should remember you." "No, I'm the youngest of the family. You would remember my older sisters, Rachel and Rebecca," I suddenly recalled. Charlie and Billy had thrown us together a lot during my visits, to keep us busy while they fished. We were all too shy to make much progress as friends. Of course, I'd kicked up enough tantrums to end the fishing trips by the time I was 11. "Are they here?" I examined the girls at the ocean's edge, wondering if I would recognize them now. "No," Jacob shook his head. "Rachel got a scholarship to Washington State, and Rebecca married a Samoan surfer. She lives in Hawaii now." "Married? Wow." I was stunned. The twins were only a little over a year older than I was. "So how do you like the truck?" he asked. "I love it. It runs great." "Yeah, but it's really slow," he laughed. I was so relieved when Charlie bought it. My dad wouldn't let me work on building another car when we had a perfectly good vehicle right there. It's not that slow, I objected. Have you tried to go over 60? No, I admitted. Good, don't, he grinned. I couldn't help grinning back. It does great in a collision, I offered in my truck's defense. I don't think a tank could take out that old monster, he agreed with another laugh. So you build cars? I asked, impressed. When I have free time, and parts. You wouldn't happen to know where I could get my hands on a master cylinder for a 1986 Volkswagen Rabbit, he added jokingly. He had a pleasant husky voice. Sorry, I laughed. I haven't seen any lately, but I'll keep my eyes open for you. As if I knew what that was. He was very easy to talk with. He flashed a brilliant smile, looking at me appreciatively in a way I was learning to recognize. I wasn't the only one who noticed. You know Bella, Jacob? Lauren asked, in what I imagined was an insolent tone from across the fire. We've sort of known each other since I was born, he laughed, smiling at me again. How nice. She didn't sound like she thought it was nice at all, and her pale, fishy eyes narrowed. Bella, she called again, watching my face carefully. I was just saying to Tyler that it was too bad none of the Cullens could come out today. Didn't anyone think to invite them? Her expression of concern was unconvincing. You mean Dr. Carlisle Cullen's family? The tall older boy asked before I could respond, much to Lauren's irritation. He was really closer to a man than a boy, and his voice was very deep. Yes, do you know them? She asked condescendingly, turning halfway toward him. The Cullens don't come here, he said in a tone that closed the subject, ignoring her question. Tyler, trying to win back her attention, asked Lauren's opinion on a CD he held. She was distracted. I stared at the deep-voiced boy, taken aback, but he was looking away toward the dark forest behind us. He'd said that the Cullens didn't come here, but his tone had implied something more, that they weren't allowed. They were prohibited. His manner left a strange impression on me, and I tried to ignore it without success. Jacob interrupted my meditation. So is Forks driving you insane yet? Oh, I'd say that's an understatement, I grimaced. He grinned understandingly. I was still turning over the brief comment on the Cullens, and I had a sudden inspiration. It was a stupid plan, but I didn't have any better ideas. I hoped that young Jacob was as yet inexperienced around girls, so that he wouldn't see through my sure-to-be-pitiful attempts at flirting. Do you want to walk down the beach with me? I asked, trying to imitate that way Edward had of looking up from underneath his eyelashes. It couldn't have nearly the same effect, I was sure, but Jacob jumped up willingly enough. As we walked north across the multi-hued stones toward the driftwood seawall, the clouds finally closed ranks across the sky, causing the sea to darken and the temperature to drop. I shoved my hands deep into the pockets of my jacket. So you're, what, 16? I asked, trying not to look like an idiot as I fluttered my eyelids the way I'd seen girls do on TV. I just turned 15, he confessed, flattered. Really? My face was full of false surprise. I would have thought you were older. I'm tall for my age, he explained. Do you come up to Forks much? I asked archly, as if I was hoping for a yes. I sounded idiotic to myself. I was afraid he would turn on me with disgust and accuse me of my fraud, but he still seemed flattered. Not too much, he admitted with a frown. But when I get my car finished, I can go up as much as I want. After I get my license, he amended. Who was that other boy Lauren was talking to? He seemed a little old to be hanging out with us. I purposefully lumped myself in with the youngsters, trying to make it clear that I preferred Jacob. That's Sam. He's 19, he informed me. What was that he was saying about the doctor's family? I asked innocently. The Cullens? Oh, they're not supposed to come onto the reservation. He looked away, out toward James Island, as he confirmed what I thought I'd heard in Sam's voice. Why not? He glanced back at me, biting his lip. Oops, I'm not supposed to say anything about that. Oh, I won't tell anyone. I'm just curious. I tried to make my smile alluring, wondering if I was laying it on too thick. He smiled back, though, looking allured. Then he lifted one eyebrow and his voice was even huskier than before. Do you like scary stories? He asked ominously. I love them, I enthused, making an effort to smolder at him. Jacob strolled to a nearby driftwood tree that had its roots sticking out like the attenuated legs of a huge pale spider. He perched lightly on one of the twisted roots while I sat beneath him on the body of the tree. He stared down at the rocks, a smile hovering around the edges of his broad lips. I could see he was going to try to make this good. I focused on keeping the vital interest I felt out of my eyes. Do you know any of our old stories about where we came from? The Quileutes, I mean, he began. Not really, I admitted. Well, there are lots of legends, some of them claiming to date back to the flood. Supposedly, the ancient Quileutes tied their canoes to the tops of the tallest trees on the mountain to survive, like Noah and the Ark. He smiled to show me how little stock he put in the histories. Another legend claims that we descended from wolves, and that the wolves are our brothers still. It's against tribal law to kill them. Then there are the stories about the Cold Ones. His voice dropped a little lower. The Cold Ones? I asked, not faking my intrigue now. Yes, there are stories of the Cold Ones as old as the wolf legends, and some much more recent. According to legend, my own great-grandfather knew some of them. He was the one who made the treaty that kept them off our land. He rolled his eyes. Your great-grandfather? I encouraged. He was a tribal elder, like my father. You see, the Cold Ones are the natural enemies of the wolf. Well, not the wolf, really, but the wolves that turn into men, like our ancestors. You would call them werewolves. Werewolves have enemies? Only one. I stared at him earnestly, hoping to disguise my impatience as admiration. So you see, Jacob continued, the Cold Ones are traditionally our enemies. But this pack that came to our territory during my great-grandfather's time was different. They didn't hunt the way others of their kind did. They weren't supposed to be dangerous to the tribe. So my great-grandfather made a truce with them. If they would promise to stay off our lands, we wouldn't expose them to the pale faces. He winked at me. If they weren't dangerous, then why? I tried to understand, struggling not to let him see how seriously I was considering his ghost story. There's always a risk for humans to be around the Cold Ones, even if they're civilized like this clan was. You never know when they might get too hungry to resist. He deliberately worked a thick edge of menace into his tone. What do you mean, civilized? They claimed that they didn't hunt humans. They supposedly were somehow able to prey on animals instead. I tried to keep my voice casual. So how does it fit in with the Cullens? Are they like the Cold Ones your great-grandfather met? No, he paused dramatically. They are the same ones. He must have thought the expression on my face was fear inspired by his story. He smiled, pleased, and continued. There are more of them now, a new female and a new male, but the rest are the same. In my great-grandfather's time, they already knew of the leader, Carlisle. He'd been here and gone before your people had even arrived. He was fighting a smile. And what are they? I finally asked. What are the Cold Ones? He smiled darkly. Blood drinkers, he replied in a chilling voice. Your people call them vampires. I stared out at the rough surf after he answered, not sure what my face was exposing. You have goosebumps, he laughed delightedly. You're a good storyteller, I complimented him, still staring into the waves. Pretty crazy stuff, though, isn't it? No wonder my dad doesn't want us to talk about it to anyone. I couldn't control my expression enough to look at him yet. Don't worry, I won't give you away. I guess I just violated the treaty, he laughed. I'll take it to the grave, I promised, and then I shivered. Seriously, though, don't say anything to Charlie. He was pretty mad at my dad when he heard that some of us weren't going to the hospital since Dr. Cullen started working there. I won't, of course not. So do you think we're a bunch of superstitious natives or what? He asked in a playful tone, but with a hint of worry. I still hadn't looked away from the ocean. I turned and smiled at him as normally as I could. No, I think you're very good at telling scary stories, though. I still have goosebumps, see? I held up my arm. Cool, he smiled. And then the sound of the beach rocks clattering against each other warned us that someone was approaching. Our heads snapped up at the same time to see Mike and Jessica about 50 yards away walking towards us. There you are, Bella, Mike called in relief, waving his arm over his head. Is that your boyfriend? Jacob asked, alerted by the jealous edge in Mike's voice. I was surprised it was so obvious. No, definitely not, I whispered. I was tremendously grateful to Jacob and eager to make him as happy as possible. I winked at him, carefully turning away from Mike to do so. He smiled, elated by my inept flirting. So when I get my license, he began, you should come see me in Forks. We could hang out sometime. I felt guilty as I said this, knowing that I'd used him. But I really did like Jacob. He was someone I could easily be friends with. Mike had reached us now, with Jessica still a few paces back. I could see his eyes appraising Jacob and looking satisfied at his obvious youth. Where have you been? He asked, though the answer was right in front of him. Jacob was just telling me some local stories, I volunteered. It was really interesting. I smiled at Jacob warmly, and he grinned back. Well, Mike paused, carefully reassessing the situation as he watched our camaraderie. We're packing up. It looks like it's going to rain soon. We all looked up at the glowering sky. It certainly did look like rain. Okay, I jumped up. I'm coming. It was nice to see you again, Jacob said. I could tell he was taunting Mike just a bit. It really was. Next time Charlie comes down to see Billy, I'll come too, I promised. His grin stretched across his face. That would be cool. And thanks, I added earnestly. I pulled up my hood as we tramped across the rocks toward the parking lot. A few drops were beginning to fall, making black spots on the stones where they landed. When we got to the Suburban, the others were already loading everything back in. I crawled into the back seat by Angela and Tyler, announcing that I'd already had my turn in the shotgun position. Angela just stared out the window at the escalating storm, and Lauren twisted around in the middle seat to occupy Tyler's attention, so I could simply lay my head back on the seat, close my eyes, and try very hard not to think. Chapter 7. Nightmare. I told Charlie I had a lot of homework to do and that I didn't want anything to eat. There was a basketball game on that he was excited about, though of course I had no idea what was special about it, so he wasn't aware of anything unusual in my face or tone. Once in my room, I locked the door. I dug through my desk until I found my old headphones, and I plugged them into my little CD player. I picked up a CD that Phil had given to me for Christmas. It was one of his favorite bands, but they used a little too much bass and shrieking for my tastes. I popped it into place and lay down on my bed. I put on the headphones, hit play, and turned up the volume until it hurt my ears. I closed my eyes, but the light still intruded, so I added a pillow over the top half of my face. I concentrated very carefully on the music, trying to understand the lyrics, to unravel the complicated drum patterns. By the third time I'd listened through the CD, I knew all the words to the choruses, at least. I was surprised to find that I really did like the band after all, once I got past the blaring noise. I'd have to thank Phil again. And it worked. The shattering beats made it impossible for me to think, which was the whole purpose of the exercise. I listened to the CD again and again until I was singing along with all the songs, until finally I fell asleep. I opened my eyes to a familiar place, aware in some corner of my consciousness that I was dreaming. I recognized the green light of the forest. I could hear the waves crashing against the rocks somewhere nearby. And I knew that if I found the ocean, I'd be able to see the sun. I was trying to follow the sound, but then Jacob Black was there, tugging on my hand, pulling me back toward the blackest part of the forest. Jacob, what's wrong? I asked. His face was frightened as he yanked with all his strength against my resistance. I didn't want to go into the dark. Run, Bella, you have to run, he whispered, terrified. This way, Bella, I recognized Mike's voice calling out of the gloomy heart of the trees, but I couldn't see him. Why? I asked, still pulling against Jacob's grasp, desperate now to find the sun. But Jacob let go of my hand and yelped, suddenly shaking, falling to the dim forest floor. He twitched on the ground as I watched in horror. "Jacob!" I screamed, but he was gone. In his place was a large red-brown wolf with black eyes. The wolf faced away from me, pointing toward the shore, the hair on the back of his shoulders bristling, low growls issuing from between his exposed fangs. "Bella, run!" Mike cried out again from behind me. But I didn't turn. I was watching a light coming toward me from the beach. And then Edward stepped out from the trees, his skin faintly glowing, his eyes black and dangerous. He held up one hand and beckoned me to come to him. The wolf growled at my feet. I took a step forward toward Edward. He smiled then, and his teeth were sharp, pointed. "Trust me," he purred. I took another step. The wolf launched himself across the space between me and the vampire, fangs aiming for the jugular. "No!" I screamed, wrenching upright out of my bed. My sudden movement caused the headphones to pull the CD player off the bedside table, and it clattered to the wooden floor. My light was still on, and I was sitting fully dressed on the bed with my shoes on. I glanced disoriented at the clock on my dresser. It was 5:30 in the morning. I groaned, fell back, and rolled over onto my face, kicking off my boots. I was too uncomfortable to get anywhere near sleep, though. I rolled back over and unbuttoned my jeans, yanking them off awkwardly as I tried to stay horizontal. I could feel the braid in my hair, an uncomfortable ridge along the back of my skull. I turned onto my side and ripped the rubber band out, quickly combing through the plaits with my fingers. I pulled the pillow back over my eyes. It was all no use, of course. My subconscious had dredged up exactly the images I'd been trying so desperately to avoid. I was going to have to face them now. I sat up, and my head spun for a minute as the blood flowed downward. First things first, I thought to myself, happy to put it off as long as possible. I grabbed my bathroom bag. The shower didn't last nearly as long as I hoped it would, though. Even taking the time to blow-dry my hair, I was soon out of things to do in the bathroom. Wrapped in a towel, I crossed back to my room. I couldn't tell if Charlie was still asleep or if he'd already left. I went to look out my window, and the cruiser was gone, fishing again. I dressed slowly in my most comfy sweats and then made my bed, something I never did. I couldn't put it off any longer. I went to my desk and switched on my old computer. I hated using the internet here. My modem was sadly outdated. My free service substandard. Just dialing up took so long that I decided to go get myself a bowl of cereal while I waited. I ate slowly, chewing each bite with care. When I was done, I washed the bowl and spoon, dried them, and put them away. My feet dragged as I climbed the stairs. I went to my CD player first, picking it up off the floor and placing it precisely in the center of the table. I pulled out the headphones and put them away in the desk drawer. Then I turned the same CD on, turning it down to the point where it was background noise. With another sigh, I turned to my computer. Naturally, the screen was covered in pop-up ads. I sat in my hard folding chair and began closing all the little windows. Eventually, I made it to my favorite search engine. I shot down a few more pop-ups and then typed in one word, vampire. It took an infuriatingly long time, of course. When the results came up, there was a lot to sift through. Everything from movies and TV shows to role-playing games, underground metal, and gothic cosmetic companies. Then I found a promising site, Vampires A to Z. I waited impatiently for it to load, quickly clicking closed each ad that flashed across the screen. Finally, the screen was finished. Simple white background with black text, academic looking. Two quotes greeted me on the homepage. "Throughout the vast shadowy world of ghosts and demons, there is no figure so terrible, no figure so dreaded and abhorred, yet dight with such fearful fascination as the vampire, who is himself neither ghost nor demon, but yet who partakes the dark natures and possesses the mysterious and terrible qualities of both. Reverend Montague Summers. If there is in this world a well-attested account, it is that of the vampires, Nothing is lacking. Official reports, affidavits of well-known people, of surgeons, of priests, of magistrates. The judicial proof is most complete. And with all that, who is there who believes in vampires? Rousseau. The rest of the site was an alphabetized listing of all the different myths of vampires held throughout the world. The first I clicked on, the Danag, was a Filipino vampire, supposedly responsible for planting taro on the islands long ago. The myth continued that the Danag worked with humans for many years, but the partnership ended one day when a woman cut her finger and a Danag sucked her wound, enjoying the taste so much that it drained her body completely of blood. I read carefully through the descriptions, looking for anything that sounded familiar, let alone plausible. It seemed that most vampire myths centered around beautiful women as demons and children as victims. They also seemed like constructs created to explain away the high mortality rates for young children and to give men an excuse for infidelity. Many of the stories involved bodiless spirits and warnings against improper burials. There wasn't much that sounded like the movies I'd seen, and only a very few, like the Hebrew Estri and the Polish Upir, who were even preoccupied with drinking blood. Only three entries really caught my attention. The Romanian Varacolaci, a powerful undead being who could appear as a beautiful pale-skinned human. The Slovak Nalapsi, a creature so strong and fast it could massacre an entire village in the single hour after midnight. And one other, the Stregoni Benefici. About this last, there was only one brief sentence. Stregoni Benefici, an Italian vampire said to be on the side of goodness and a mortal enemy of all evil vampires. It was a relief that one small entry, the one myth among hundreds that claimed the existence of good vampires. Overall, though, there was little that coincided with Jacob's stories or my own observations. I'd made a little catalog in my mind as I'd read and carefully compared it with each myth. Speed, strength, beauty, pale skin, eyes that shift color, and then Jacob's criteria. Blood drinkers, enemies of the werewolf, cold-skinned, and immortal. There were very few myths that matched even one factor. And then another problem, one that I'd remembered from the small number of scary movies that I'd seen and was backed up by today's reading. Vampires couldn't come out in the daytime. The sun would burn them to a cinder. They slept in coffins all day and came out only at night. Aggravated, I snapped off the computer's main power switch, not waiting to shut things down properly. Through my irritation, I felt overwhelming embarrassment. It was all so stupid. I was sitting in my room researching vampires. What was wrong with me? I decided that most of the blame belonged on the doorstep of the town of Forks, and the entire sodden Olympic Peninsula, for that matter. I had to get out of the house, but there was nowhere I wanted to go that didn't involve a 3-day drive. I pulled on my boots anyway, unclear where I was headed, and went downstairs. I shrugged into my raincoat without checking the weather and stomped out the door. It was overcast, but not raining yet. I ignored my truck and started east on foot, angling across Charlie's yard toward the ever-encroaching forest. It didn't take long till I was deep enough for the house and the road to be invisible, for the only sound to be the squish of the damp earth under my feet and the sudden cries of the jays. There was a thin ribbon of a trail that led through the forest here, or I wouldn't risk wandering on my own like this. My sense of direction was hopeless. I could get lost in much less helpful surroundings. The trail wound deeper and deeper into the forest, mostly east as far as I could tell. It snaked around the Sitka spruces and the hemlocks, the yews and the maples. I only vaguely knew the names of the trees around me, and all I knew was due to Charlie pointing them out to me from the cruiser window in earlier days. There were many I didn't know, and others I couldn't be sure about because they were so covered in green parasites. I followed the trail as long as my anger at myself pushed me forward. As that started to ebb, I slowed. A few drops of moisture trickled down from the canopy above me, but I couldn't be certain if it was beginning to rain or if it was simply pools left over from yesterday, held high in the leaves above me, slowly dripping their way back to the earth. A recently fallen tree, I knew it was recent because it wasn't entirely carpeted in moss, rested against the trunk of one of her sisters, creating a sheltered little bench just a few safe feet off the trail. I stepped over the ferns and sat carefully, making sure my jacket was between the damp seat and my clothes wherever they touched, and leaned my hooded head back against the living tree. This was the wrong place to have come. I should have known, but where else was there to go? The forest was deep green and far too much like the scene in last night's dream to allow for peace of mind. Now that there was no longer the sound of my soggy footsteps, the silence was piercing. The birds were quiet too, the drops increasing in frequency, so it must be raining above. The ferns stood higher than my head now that I was seated, and I knew someone could walk by on the path 3 feet away and not see me. Here in the trees, it was much easier to believe the absurdities that embarrassed me indoors. Nothing had changed in this forest for thousands of years, and all the myths and legends of 100 different lands seemed much more likely in this green haze than they had in my clear-cut bedroom. I forced myself to focus on the 2 most vital questions I had to answer, but I did so unwillingly. First, I had to decide if it was possible that what Jacob had said about the Cullens could be true. Immediately, my mind responded with a resounding negative. It was silly and morbid to entertain such ridiculous notions. But what then? I asked myself. There was no rational explanation for how I was alive at this moment. I listed again in my head the things I'd observed myself. The impossible speed and strength. The eye color shifting from black to gold and back again. The inhuman beauty. The pale, frigid skin. And more small things that registered slowly. How they never seemed to eat. The disturbing grace with which they moved. And the way he sometimes spoke, with unfamiliar cadences and phrases that better fit the style of a turn-of-the-century novel than that of a 21st-century classroom. He had skipped class the day we'd done blood typing. He hadn't said no to the beach trip till he heard where we were going. He seemed to know what everyone around him was thinking, except me. He had told me he was the villain, dangerous. Could the Cullens be vampires? Well, they were something. Something outside the possibility of rational justification was taking place in front of my incredulous eyes. Whether it be Jacob's cold ones or my own superhero theory, Edward Cullen was not human. He was something more. So then, maybe. That would have to be my answer for now. And then the most important question of all, what was I going to do if it was true? If Edward was a vampire, I could hardly make myself think the words. Then what should I do? Involving someone else was definitely out. I couldn't even believe myself. Anyone I told would have me committed. Only 2 options seemed practical. The first was to take his advice, to be smart, to avoid him as much as possible, to cancel our plans, to go back to ignoring him as far as I was able. To pretend there was an impenetrably thick glass wall between us and the one class where we were forced together. To tell him to leave me alone, and mean it this time. I was gripped in a sudden agony of despair as I considered that alternative. My mind rejected the pain, quickly skipping on to the next option. I could do nothing different. After all, if he was something sinister, he'd done nothing to hurt me so far. In fact, I would be a dent in Tyler's fender if he hadn't acted so quickly. So quickly, I argued with myself, that it might have been sheer reflexes. But if it was a reflex to save lives, how bad could he be? I retorted. My head spun around in answerless circles. There was one thing I was sure of, if I was sure of anything. The dark Edward in my dream last night was a reflection only of my fear of the word Jacob had spoken. And not Edward himself. Even so, when I'd screamed out in terror at the werewolf's lunge, it wasn't fear for the wolf that brought the cry of no to my lips. It was fear that he would be harmed. Even as he called to me with sharp-edged fangs, I feared for him. And I knew in that I had my answer. I didn't know if there ever was a choice, really. I was already in too deep. Now that I knew, if I knew, I could do nothing about my frightening secret, because when I thought of him, of his voice, his hypnotic eyes, the magnetic force of his personality, I wanted nothing more than to be with him right now. Even if, but I couldn't think it. Not here alone in the darkening forest. Not while the rain made it dim as twilight under the canopy and pattered like footsteps across the matted earthen floor. I shivered and rose quickly from my place of concealment, worried that somehow the path would have disappeared with the rain. But it was there, safe and clear, winding its way out of the dripping green maze. I followed it hastily, my hood pulled close around my face, becoming surprised as I nearly ran through the trees at how far I had come. I started to wonder if I was heading out at all, or following the path farther into the confines of the forest. Before I could get too panicky, though, I began to glimpse some open spaces through the webbed branches. And then I could hear a car passing on the street, and I was free. Charlie's lawn stretched out in front of me, the house beckoning me, promising warmth and dry socks. It was just noon when I got back inside. I went upstairs and got dressed for the day, jeans and a t-shirt, since I was staying indoors. It didn't take too much effort to concentrate on my task for the day, a paper on Macbeth that was due Wednesday. I settled into outlining a rough draft contentedly, more serene than I'd felt since, well, since Thursday afternoon, if I was being honest. That had always been my way, though. Making decisions was the painful part for me, the part I agonized over. But once the decision was made, I simply followed through, usually with relief that the choice was made. Sometimes the relief was tainted by despair, like my decision to come to Forks, but it was still better than wrestling with the alternatives. This decision was ridiculously easy to live with, dangerously easy. And so the day was quiet, productive. I finished my paper before 8. Charlie came home with a large catch, and I made a mental note to pick up a book of recipes for fish while I was in Seattle next week. The chills that flashed up my spine whenever I thought of that trip were no different than the ones I'd felt before I'd taken my walk with Jacob Black. They should be different, I thought. I should be afraid. I knew I should be, but I couldn't feel the right kind of fear. I slept dreamlessly that night, exhausted from beginning my day so early, and sleeping so poorly the night before. I woke for the second time since arriving in Forks to the bright yellow light of a sunny day. I skipped to the window, stunned to see that there was hardly a cloud in the sky, and those there were just fleecy little white puffs that couldn't possibly be carrying any rain. I opened the window, surprised when it opened silently, without sticking, not having opened it in who knows how many years, and sucked in the relatively dry air. It was nearly warm and hardly windy at all. My blood was electric in my veins. Charlie was finishing breakfast when I came downstairs, and he picked up on my mood immediately. "Nice day out," he commented. "Yes," I agreed with a grin. He smiled back, his brown eyes crinkling around the edges. When Charlie smiled, it was easier to see why he and my mother had jumped too quickly into an early marriage. Most of the young romantic he'd been in those days had faded before I'd known him, as the curly brown hair, the same color, if not the same texture as mine, had dwindled, slowly revealing more and more of the shiny skin of his forehead. But when he smiled, I could see a little of the man who'd run away with Renee when she was just 2 years older than I was now. I ate breakfast cheerily, watching the dust motes stirring in the sunlight that streamed in the back window. Charlie called out a goodbye, and I heard the cruiser pull away from the house. I hesitated on my way out the door, hand on my rain jacket. It would be tempting fate to leave it home. With a sigh, I folded it over my arm and stepped out into the brightest light I'd seen in months. By dint of much elbow grease, I was able to get both windows in the truck almost completely rolled down. I was one of the first ones to school. I hadn't even checked the clock in my hurry to get outside. I parked and headed toward the seldom-used picnic benches on the south side of the cafeteria. The benches were still a little damp, so I sat on my jacket, glad to have a use for it. My homework was done, the product of a slow social life, but there were a few trig problems I wasn't sure I had right. I took out my book industriously, but halfway through rechecking the first problem, I was daydreaming, watching the sunlight play on the red-barked trees. I sketched inattentively along the margins of my homework. After a few minutes, I suddenly realized I'd drawn 5 pairs of dark eyes staring out of the page at me. I scrubbed them out with the eraser. "Bella," I heard someone call, and it sounded like Mike. I looked around to realize that the school had become populated while I'd been sitting there absent-minded. Everyone was in t-shirts, some even in shorts, though the temperature couldn't be over 60. Mike was coming toward me in khaki shorts and a striped rugby shirt, waving. "Hey, Mike," I called, waving back, unable to be half-hearted on a morning like this. He came to sit by me, the tidy spikes of his hair shining golden in the light, his grin stretching across his face. He was so delighted to see me, I couldn't help but feel gratified. "I never noticed before. Your hair has red in it," he commented, catching between his fingers a strand that was fluttering in the light breeze. "Only in the sun." I became just a little uncomfortable as he tucked the lock behind my ear. "Great day, isn't it?" "My kind of day," I agreed. "What did you do yesterday?" His tone was just a bit too proprietary. "I mostly worked on my essay." I didn't add that I was finished with it. No need to sound smug. He hit his forehead with the heel of his hand. "Oh, yeah. That's due Thursday, right?" "Wednesday, I think." "Wednesday," he frowned. "That's not good. What are you writing yours on?" "Whether Shakespeare's treatment of the female characters is misogynistic?" He stared at me like I'd just spoken in pig Latin. "I guess I'll have to get to work on that tonight," he said, deflated. "I was going to ask if you wanted to go out." "Oh," I was taken off guard. Why couldn't I ever have a pleasant conversation with Mike anymore without it getting awkward? "Well, we could go to dinner or something, and I could work on it later," he smiled at me hopefully. "Mike," I hated being put on the spot. "I don't think that would be the best idea." His face fell. "Why?" he asked, his eyes guarded. My thoughts flickered to Edward, wondering if that's where his thoughts were as well. "I think, and if you ever repeat what I'm saying right now, I will cheerfully beat you to death," I threatened. "But I think that would hurt Jessica's feelings." He was bewildered, obviously not thinking in that direction at all. "Jessica? Really, Mike, are you blind?" "Oh," he exhaled, clearly dazed. I took advantage of that to make my escape. "It's time for class and I can't be late again." I gathered my books up and stuffed them in my bag. We walked in silence to Building 3, and his expression was distracted. I hoped whatever thoughts he was immersed in were leading him in the right direction. When I saw Jessica and Trig, she was bubbling with enthusiasm. She, Angela, and Lauren were going to Port Angeles tonight to go dress shopping for the dance, and she wanted me to come too, even though I didn't need one. I was indecisive. It would be nice to get out of town with some girlfriends, but Lauren would be there. And who knew what I could be doing tonight? But that was definitely the wrong path to let my mind wander down. Of course, I was happy about the sunlight, but that wasn't completely responsible for the euphoric mood I was in, not even close. So I gave her a maybe, telling her I'd have to talk with Charlie first. She talked of nothing but the dance on the way to Spanish, continuing as if without an interruption when class finally ended, 5 minutes late, and we were on our way to lunch. I was far too lost in my own frenzy of anticipation to notice much of what she said. I was painfully eager to see not just him, but all the Cullens, to compare them with the new suspicions that plagued my mind. As I crossed the threshold of the cafeteria, I felt the first true tingle of fear slither down my spine and settle in my stomach. Would they be able to know what I was thinking? And then a different feeling jolted through me. Would Edward be waiting to sit with me again? As was my routine, I glanced first toward the Cullens' table. A shiver of panic trembled in my stomach as I realized it was empty. With dwindling hope, my eyes scoured the rest of the cafeteria, hoping to find him alone, waiting for me. The place was nearly filled. Spanish had made us late, but there was no sign of Edward or any of his family. Desolation hit me with crippling strength. I shambled along behind Jessica, not bothering to pretend to listen anymore. We were late enough that everyone was already at our table. I avoided the empty chair next to Mike in favor of one by Angela. I vaguely noticed that Mike held the chair out politely for Jessica and that her face lit up in response. Angela asked a few quiet questions about the Macbeth paper, which I answered as naturally as I could while spiraling downward in misery. She too invited me to go with them tonight, and I agreed now, grasping at anything to distract myself. I realized I'd been holding on to a last shred of hope when I entered biology, saw his empty seat, and felt a new wave of disappointment. The rest of the day passed slowly, dismally. In gym, we had a lecture on the rules of badminton, the next torture they had lined up for me. But at least it meant I got to sit and listen instead of stumbling around on the court. The best part was the coach didn't finish, so I got another day off tomorrow. Never mind that the day after they would arm me with a racket before unleashing me on the rest of the class. I was glad to leave campus, so I would be free to pout and mope before I went out tonight with Jessica and company. But right after I walked in the door of Charlie's house, Jessica called to cancel our plans. I tried to be happy that Mike had asked her out to dinner. I really was relieved that he finally seemed to be catching on, but my enthusiasm sounded false in my own ears. She rescheduled our shopping trip for tomorrow night, which left me with little in the way of distractions. I had fish marinating for dinner, with a salad and bread left over from the night before, so there was nothing to do there. I spent a focused half hour on homework, but then I was through with that too. I checked my email, reading the backlog of letters from my mother, getting snippier as they progressed to the present. I sighed and typed a quick response. "Mom, sorry, I've been out. I went to the beach with some friends, and I had to write a paper." My excuses were fairly pathetic, so I gave up on that. "It's sunny outside today." "I know, I'm shocked too. So I'm going to go outside and soak up as much vitamin D as I can. I love you, Bella." I decided to kill an hour with non-school-related reading. I had a small collection of books that came with me to Forks, the shabbiest volume being a compilation of the works of Jane Austen. I selected that one and headed to the backyard, grabbing a ragged old quilt from the linen cupboard at the top of the stairs on my way down. Outside in Charlie's small, square yard, I folded the quilt in half and laid it out of the reach of the tree's shadows on the thick lawn that would always be slightly wet, no matter how long the sun shone. I lay on my stomach, crossing my ankles in the air, flipping through the different novels in the book, trying to decide which would occupy my mind the most thoroughly. My favorites were Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility. I'd read the first most recently, so I started into Sense and Sensibility, only to remember after I began chapter 3 that the hero of the story happened to be named Edward. Angrily, I turned to Mansfield Park, but the hero of that piece was named Edmund, and that was just too close. Weren't there any other names available in the late 18th century? I snapped the book shut, annoyed, and rolled over onto my back. I pushed my sleeves up as high as they would go and closed my eyes. I would think of nothing but the warmth on my skin, I told myself severely. The breeze was still light, but it blew tendrils of my hair around my face, and that tickled a bit. I pulled all my hair over my head, letting it fan out on the quilt above me, and focused again on the heat that touched my eyelids, my cheekbones, my nose, my lips, my forearms, my neck, soaked through my light shirt. The next thing I was conscious of was the sound of Charlie's cruiser turning onto the bricks of the driveway. I sat up in surprise, realizing the light was gone behind the trees and I had fallen asleep. I looked around, muddled, with a sudden feeling that I wasn't alone. "Charlie?" I asked, but I could hear his door slamming in front of the house. I jumped up, foolishly edgy, gathering the now damp quilt and my book. I ran inside to get some oil heating on the stove, realizing that dinner would be late. Charlie was hanging up his gun belt and stepping out of his boots when I came in. "Sorry, Dad, dinner's not ready yet. I fell asleep outside." I stifled a yawn. "Don't worry about it," he said. "I wanted to catch the score on the game anyway." I watched TV with Charlie after dinner, for something to do. There wasn't anything on I wanted to watch, but he knew I didn't like baseball, so he turned it to some mindless sitcom that neither of us enjoyed. He seemed happy, though, to be doing something together, and it felt good, despite my depression, to make him happy. "Dad," I said during a commercial, "Jessica and Angela are going to look at dresses for the dance tomorrow night in Port Angeles, and they wanted me to help them choose. Do you mind if I go with them?" "Jessica Stanley?" he asked. "And Angela Weber," I sighed as I gave him the details. He was confused. "But you're not going to the dance, right?" "No, Dad, but I'm helping them find dresses. You know, giving them constructive criticism. I wouldn't have to explain this to a woman." "Well, okay." He seemed to realize that he was out of his depth with the girly stuff. "It's a school night, though." "We'll leave right after school so we can get back early. You'll be okay for dinner, right?" "Bells, I fed myself for 17 years before you got here," he reminded me. "I don't know how you survived," I muttered, and then added more clearly, "I'll leave some things for cold cut sandwiches in the fridge, okay? Right on top." It was sunny again in the morning. I awakened with renewed hope that I grimly tried to suppress. I dressed for the warmer weather in a deep blue V-neck blouse, something I'd worn in the dead of winter in Phoenix. I planned my arrival at school so that I barely had time to make it to class. With a sinking heart, I circled the full lot looking for a space, while also searching for the silver Volvo that was clearly not there. I parked in the last row and hurried to English, arriving breathless but subdued before the final bell. It was the same as yesterday. I just couldn't keep little sprouts of hope from budding in my mind, only to have them squashed painfully as I searched the lunchroom in vain and sat at my empty biology table. The Port Angeles scheme was back on again for tonight, and made all the more attractive by the fact that Lauren had other obligations. I was anxious to get out of town so I could stop glancing over my shoulder, hoping to see him appearing out of the blue the way he always did. I vowed to myself that I would be in a good mood tonight and not ruin Angela's or Jessica's enjoyment in the dress hunting. Maybe I could do a little clothes shopping as well. I refused to think that I might be shopping alone in Seattle this weekend, no longer interested in the earlier arrangement. Surely he wouldn't cancel without at least telling me. After school, Jessica followed me home in her old white Mercury so that I could ditch my books and truck. I brushed through my hair quickly when I was inside, feeling a slight lift of excitement as I contemplated getting out of Forks. I left a note for Charlie on the table explaining again where to find dinner, switched my scruffy wallet from my school bag to a purse I rarely used, and ran out to join Jessica. We went to Angela's house next, and she was waiting for us. My excitement increased exponentially as we actually drove out of the town limits. Chapter 8. Port Angeles. Jess drove faster than the chief, so we made it to Port Angeles by 4. It had been a while since I'd had a girls' night out, and the estrogen rush was invigorating. We listened to whiny rock songs while Jessica jabbered on about the boys we hung out with. Jessica's dinner with Mike had gone very well, and she was hoping that by Saturday night they would have progressed to the first kiss stage. I smiled to myself, pleased. Angela was passively happy to be going to the dance, but not really interested in Eric. Jess tried to get her to confess who her type was, but I interrupted with a question about dresses after a bit, to spare her. Angela threw a grateful glance my way. Port Angeles was a beautiful little tourist trap, much more polished and quaint than Forks. But Jessica and Angela knew it well, so they didn't plan to waste time on the picturesque boardwalk by the bay. Jess drove straight to the one big department store in town, which was a few streets in from the Bay Area's visitor-friendly face. The dance was billed as semi-formal, and we weren't exactly sure what that meant. Both Jessica and Angela seemed surprised and almost disbelieving when I told them I'd never been to a dance in Phoenix. "Didn't you ever go with a boyfriend or something?" Jess asked dubiously as we walked through the front doors of the store. "Really?" I tried to convince her, not wanting to confess my dancing problems. "I've never had a boyfriend or anything close. I didn't go out much." "Why not?" Jessica demanded. "No one asked me," I answered honestly. She looked skeptical. "People ask you out here," she reminded me, "and you tell them no." We were in the junior section now, scanning the racks for dress-up clothes. "Well, except for Tyler," Angela amended quietly. "Excuse me?" I gasped. "What did you say?" Tyler told everyone he's taking you to prom, Jessica informed me with suspicious eyes. He said what? I sounded like I was choking. I told you it wasn't true, Angela murmured to Jessica. I was silent, still lost in shock that was quickly turning to irritation. But we had found the dress racks, and now we had work to do. That's why Lauren doesn't like you, Jessica giggled while we pawed through the clothes. I ground my teeth. Do you think that if I ran him over with my truck, he would stop feeling guilty about the accident? That he might give up on making amends and call it even? Maybe, Jess snickered, if that's why he's doing this. The dress selection wasn't large, but both of them found a few things to try on. I sat on a low chair just inside the dressing room by the three-way mirror, trying to control my fuming. Jess was torn between two, one a long, strapless, basic black number, the other a knee-length, electric blue with spaghetti straps. I encouraged her to go with the blue. Why not play up the eyes? Angela chose a pale pink dress that draped around her tall frame nicely and brought out honey tints in her light brown hair. I complimented them both generously and helped by returning the rejects to their racks. The whole process was much shorter and easier than similar trips I'd taken with Renee at home. I guess there was something to be said for limited choices. We headed over to shoes and accessories. While they tried things on, I merely watched and critiqued, not in the mood to shop for myself, though I did need new shoes. The girl's night high was wearing off in the wake of my annoyance at Tyler, leaving room for the gloom to move back in. Angela? I began, hesitant, while she was trying on a pair of pink strappy heels. She was overjoyed to have a date tall enough that she could wear high heels at all. Jessica had drifted to the jewelry counter and we were alone. Yes? She held her leg out, twisting her ankle to get a better view of the shoe. I chickened out. I like those. I think I'll get them, though they'll never match anything but the one dress, she mused. Oh, go ahead. They're on sale, I encouraged. She smiled, putting the lid back on a box that contained more practical-looking off-white shoes. I tried again. Angela? She looked up curiously. Is it normal for the Cullens, I kept my eyes on the shoes, to be out of school a lot? I failed miserably in my attempt to sound nonchalant. Yes, when the weather is good, they go backpacking all the time, even the doctor. They're all real outdoorsy, she told me quietly, examining her shoes too. She didn't ask one question, let alone the hundreds that Jessica would have unleashed. I was beginning to really like Angela. Oh. I let the subject drop as Jessica returned to show us the rhinestone jewelry she'd found to match her silver shoes. We planned to go to dinner at a little Italian restaurant on the boardwalk, but the dress shopping hadn't taken as long as we'd expected. Jess and Angela were going to take their clothes back to the car and then walk down to the bay. I told them I would meet them at the restaurant in an hour. I wanted to look for a bookstore. They were both willing to come with me, but I encouraged them to go have fun. They didn't know how preoccupied I could get when surrounded by books. It was something I preferred to do alone. They walked off to the car, chattering happily, and I headed in the direction Jess pointed out. I had no trouble finding the bookstore, but it wasn't what I was looking for. The windows were full of crystals, dream catchers, and books about spiritual healing. I didn't even go inside. Through the glass, I could see a 50-year-old woman with long gray hair worn straight down her back, clad in a dress right out of the 60s, smiling welcomingly from behind the counter. I decided that was one conversation I could skip. There had to be a normal bookstore in town. I meandered through the streets, which were filling up with end-of-the-workday traffic, and hoped I was headed toward downtown. I wasn't paying as much attention as I should to where I was going. I was wrestling with despair. I was trying so hard not to think about him and what Angela had said. More than anything, trying to beat down my hopes for Saturday, fearing a disappointment more painful than the rest, when I looked up to see someone's silver Volvo parked along the street, and it all came crashing down on me. Stupid, unreliable vampire, I thought to myself. I stomped along in a southerly direction, towards some glass-fronted shops that looked promising. But when I got to them, they were just a repair shop and a vacant space. I still had too much time to go looking for Jess and Angela yet, and I definitely needed to get my mood in hand before I met back up with them. I ran my fingers through my hair a couple of times and took some deep breaths before I continued around the corner. I started to realize, as I crossed another road, that I was going the wrong direction. The little foot traffic I had seen was going north, and it looked like the buildings here were mostly warehouses. I decided to turn east at the next corner and then loop around after a few blocks and try my luck on a different street on my way back to the boardwalk. A group of four men turned around the corner I was heading for, dressed too casually to be heading home from the office, but they were too grimy to be tourists. As they approached me, I realized they weren't too many years older than I was. They were joking loudly among themselves, laughing raucously and punching each other's arms. I scooted as far to the inside of the sidewalk as I could to give them room, walking swiftly, looking past them to the corner. "Hey there," one of them called as they passed, and he had to be talking to me since no one else was around. I glanced up automatically. Two of them had paused, the other two were slowing. The closest, a heavy-set, dark-haired man in his early 20s, seemed to be the one who had spoken. He was wearing a flannel shirt open over a dirty t-shirt, cut-off jeans and sandals. He took half a step toward me. "Hello," I mumbled, a knee-jerk reaction, and I quickly looked away and walked faster toward the corner. I could hear them laughing at full volume behind me. "Hey, wait," one of them called after me again, but I kept my head down and rounded the corner with a sigh of relief. I could still hear them chortling behind me. I found myself on a sidewalk leading past the backs of several somber-colored warehouses, each with large bay doors for unloading trucks, padlocked for the night. The south side of the street had no sidewalk, only a chain-link fence topped with barbed wire protecting some kind of engine parts storage yard. I'd wandered far past the part of Port Angeles that I, as a guest, was intended to see. It was getting dark, I realized, the clouds finally returning, piling up on the western horizon, creating an early sunset. The eastern sky was still clear, but graying, shot through with streaks of pink and orange. I left my jacket in the car, and a sudden shiver made me cross my arms tightly across my chest. A single van passed me, and then the road was empty. The sky suddenly darkened further, and as I looked over my shoulder to glare at the offending cloud, I realized with a shock that two men were walking quietly 20 feet behind me. They were from the same group I'd passed at the corner, though neither was the dark one who'd spoken to me. I turned my head forward at once, quickening my pace. A chill that had nothing to do with the weather made me shiver again. My purse was on a shoulder strap, and I had it slung across my body, the way you were supposed to wear it, so it wouldn't get snatched. I knew exactly where my pepper spray was, still in my duffel bag under the bed, never unpacked. I didn't have much money with me, just a 20 and some ones, and I thought about accidentally dropping my bag and walking away, but a small, frightened voice in the back of my mind warned me that they might be something worse than thieves. I listened intently to their quiet footsteps, which were much too quiet when compared to the boisterous noise they'd been making earlier, and it didn't sound like they were speeding up or getting any closer to me. "Breathe," I had to remind myself. "You don't know they're following you." I continued to walk as quickly as I could without actually running, focusing on the right-hand turn that was only a few yards away from me now. I could hear them, staying as far back as they'd been before. A blue car turned onto the street from the south and drove quickly past me. I thought of jumping out in front of it, but I hesitated, inhibited, unsure that I was really being pursued, and then it was too late. I reached the corner, but a swift glance revealed that it was only a blind drive to the back of another building. I was half-turned in anticipation. I had to hurriedly correct and dash across the narrow drive back to the sidewalk. The street ended at the next corner where there was a stop sign. I concentrated on the faint footsteps behind me, deciding whether or not to run. They sounded farther back, though, and I knew they could outrun me in any case. I was sure to trip and go sprawling if I tried to go any faster. The footfalls were definitely farther back. I risked a quick glance over my shoulder, and they were maybe 40 feet back now, I saw with relief. But they were both staring at me. It seemed to take forever for me to get to the corner, I kept my pace steady, the men behind me falling ever so slightly farther behind with every step. Maybe they realized they had scared me and were sorry. I saw two cars going north past the intersection I was heading for, and I exhaled in relief. There would be more people around once I got off this deserted street. I skipped around the corner with a grateful sigh and skidded to a stop. The street was lined on both sides by blank, doorless, windowless walls. I could see in the distance, two intersections down, street lamps, cars, and more pedestrians, but they were all too far away, because lounging against the Western building, midway down the street, were the other two men from the group, both watching with excited smiles as I froze dead on the sidewalk. I realized then that I wasn't being followed. I was being herded. I paused for only a second, but it felt like a very long time. I turned then and darted to the other side of the road. I had a sinking feeling that it was a wasted attempt. The footsteps behind me were louder now. "There you are," the booming voice of the stocky, dark-haired man shattered the intense quiet and made me jump. In the gathering darkness, it seemed like he was looking past me. "Yeah," a voice called loudly from behind me, making me jump again as I tried to hurry down the street. "We just took a little detour." My steps had to slow now. I was closing the distance between myself and the lounging pair too quickly. I had a good loud scream, and I sucked in air, preparing to use it, but my throat was so dry I wasn't sure how much volume I could manage. With a quick movement, I slipped my purse over my head, gripping the strap with one hand, ready to surrender it or use it as a weapon as need demanded. The thick-set man shrugged away from the wall as I warily came to a stop and walked slowly into the street. "Stay away from me," I warned in a voice that was supposed to sound strong and fearless, but I was right about the dry throat, no volume. "Don't be like that, sugar," he called, and the raucous laughter started again behind me. I braced myself, feet apart, trying to remember through my panic what little self-defense I knew. Heel of the hand thrust upward, hopefully breaking the nose or shoving it into the brain. Finger through the eye socket, try to hook around and pop the eye out. And the standard knee to the groin, of course. That same pessimistic voice in my mind spoke up then, reminding me that I probably wouldn't have a chance against one of them, and there were four. "Shut up," I commanded the voice before terror could incapacitate me. I wasn't going out without taking someone with me. I tried to swallow so I could build up a decent scream. Headlights suddenly flew around the corner, the car almost hitting the stocky one, forcing him to jump back toward the sidewalk. I dove into the road. This car was going to stop or have to hit me. But the silver car unexpectedly fishtailed around, skidding to a stop with the passenger door open just a few feet from me. "Get in," a furious voice commanded. It was amazing how instantaneously the choking fear vanished. Amazing how suddenly the feeling of security washed over me, even before I was off the street, as soon as I heard his voice. I jumped into the seat, slamming the door shut behind me. It was dark in the car. No light had come on with the opening of the door, and I could barely see his face in the glow from the dashboard. The tires squealed as he spun around to face north, accelerating too quickly, swerving toward the stunned men on the street. I caught a glimpse of them diving for the sidewalk as we straightened out and sped toward the harbor. "Put on your seatbelt," he commanded, and I realized I was clutching the seat with both hands. I quickly obeyed. The snap as the belt connected was loud in the darkness. He took a sharp left, racing forward, blowing through several stop signs without a pause. But I felt utterly safe, and for the moment, totally unconcerned about where we were going. I stared at his face in profound relief, relief that went beyond my sudden deliverance. I studied his flawless features in the limited light, waiting for my breath to return to normal, until it occurred to me that his expression was murderously angry. "Are you okay?" I asked, surprised at how hoarse my voice sounded. "No," he said curtly, and his tone was livid. I sat in silence, watching his face while his blazing eyes stared straight ahead until the car came to a sudden stop. I glanced around, but it was too dark to see anything besides the vague outline of dark trees crowding the roadside. We weren't in town anymore. "Bella?" he asked, his voice tight, controlled. Yes? My voice was still rough. I tried to clear my throat quietly. Are you all right? He still didn't look at me, but the fury was plain on his face. Yes, I croaked softly. Distract me, please, he ordered. I'm sorry, what? He exhaled sharply. Just prattle about something unimportant until I calm down, he clarified, closing his eyes and pinching the bridge of his nose with his thumb and forefinger. I racked my brain for something trivial. I'm going to run over Tyler Crowley tomorrow before school. He was still squeezing his eyes closed, but the corner of his mouth twitched.